No one had warned him to expect enemy forces, and especially not Carizian forces, from the west, however. Worse, he hadn't even a whisper of warning until yesterday evening, when he'd ordered Singleton to send out scouts to identify the unknown interlopers reported at Karmic. He'd hoped, or allowed himself to hope, that it might be Duke Harless's vanguard, although the timing had been against it. His next preferred outcome would have been for the report to prove an unfounded rumor. His least preferred outcome was for it to turn out to be the enemy instead. He wasn't any too happy that they'd gotten this far south before anyone even noticed them either. Still, the territory west of Fort Terrace had been virtually depopulated in the Rising, so it probably shouldn't be too surprising that the heretics hadn't been spotted sooner. But Carizians? Reliable news had been hard to come by from the beginning, yet nothing he'd heard had suggested the heretics might dare to withdraw troops from the outnumbered blocking force facing Bishop Militant Conier along the Divan. But where else could they have come from, assuming Singleton's cavalry had identified them properly? The only way they could have gotten here was down the Branath Canal, and Walkyear drummed nervously on the windowsill as he considered that. Father Niklos Vonhain, the Schulerite underpriest who joined Walkyear in his seizure of Fort Terrace, had been confirmed as his special intendant as soon as they'd been able to communicate with Mother Church. And they'd received the Inquisitor General's authorization to destroy canal locks if the Jihad required it 3 months ago. In fact, Colonel Martin, commanding the 6th Infantry Regiment, had urged Walkyear to destroy or disable the Branath Canal locks at least as far as the point at which it crossed the Karmic Fort St. Clair High Road. He'd wanted to go further than that, in fact, and put the entire southernmost 300 or 400 miles of the canal completely out of service. Colonel Zomson, commanding the 15th Infantry Regiment, had agreed with Martin, and Walkyear had been torn between agreeing with them and preserving a vital resource. His decision has been complicated by the need to assert his authority. Martin and Zomson were both regulars, just as Walkyear had been, but whereas Zomson and Walkyear had been captains before the Rising, Martin had been a major. Walkyear's present rank had been self-granted, with Father Naglos's strong backing, on the basis that the man who'd successfully seized Fort Terrace from its garrison was the logical officer to command its defense. His promotion had been confirmed by the Office of the Inquisition, and Martin and Zomson had accepted it, however grudgingly. Despite that, Martin, as the officer who'd brought 60% of his regiment over to the faithful intact, clearly resented his subordination. Zomson might as well, but if so, he concealed it better. However obediently Martin accepted Walkyear's orders, it was obvious he felt he ought to have been placed in command. That created certain problems where it came to taking Martin's advice, since it was vital to avoid the appearance that Walkyear was dancing to the colonel's direction. Despite that, Walkyear had been inclined to go along with him, at least as far as disabling the locks between Karmic and the fort. His earlier orders from Mother Church, however, had stressed the importance of preserving the canal so that the forces advancing out of Desnair would be able to move rapidly into the rear of the heretics facing the army of Glacierheart, if that proved necessary. No one had changed those orders, and Father Naklos had argued vehemently that destroying locks when there weren't even any enemy troops in the vicinity would run directly counter to Mother Church's overall strategy.
And he was right, Walkyear thought now, glumly. But I thought we'd know when the heretics headed this way, that there'd be time to do something about the canal before they actually got here.
Unfortunately, he'd been wrong.
Maybe it's going to turn out to be a good thing all those damned militia turned up after all.
Walkyear's lips twitched humorlessly.
If Singleton's right, figuring out how to feed them over the winter's likely to be the least of my problems.
He inhaled again, deeply, then returned to his desk and rang the handbell. The office door popped open almost instantly.
Yes, sir?
Meeting here in my office in 20 minutes, Walkyear said,
rather more crisply than he actually felt.
All regimental commanders.
Yes, sir.
The orderly saluted and disappeared once more, and Walker seated himself back behind his desk and put his head in his hands as the door closed.
Don't we have any better idea of the numbers? Major Bryan Kirbish asked.
Kirbish commanded the 3rd Maidenburg Militia, the most recently formed of Walker's original regiments. He was also the youngest of the general's regimental commanders, a black-haired, brown-eyed, intensely focused young man with a manner which fringed on the abrupt as often as not.
No,
Colonel Clerc Singleton replied a bit repressively. Kirbish looked at him, and Singleton shrugged.
Their cavalry screen's too strong to penetrate. All I can tell you for certain is that there's infantry, and presumably guns, coming at us from both sides.
Kirbish looked less than delighted, but then he and Singleton didn't much like each other. Kirbish was perfectly prepared to burn out heretic farms or towns, but he disapproved of disorganized, disorderly freelance activities, whereas Singleton's cavalrymen had spent a lot of time doing just that. In fact, Singleton had been busier setting fires than recruiting additional troopers. During the time Kirbish, Colonel Michael Zomson, and Colonel Nathalin Hopkinson had created their Maidenburg militia regiments virtually from scratch, Singleton's strength had actually declined. Admittedly, it took longer to train cavalry than infantry, but Singleton had used up men and worn out and broken down far too many irreplaceable horses on raids to burn already abandoned farms, and however satisfying his men might have found their efforts, arson didn't seem to have produced the information on enemy movements cavalry was supposed to provide.
Without more information, I don't see how any of us can contribute any useful advance, sir,
Kirbish said after a moment, turning back to Walker.
We all understand the importance of holding the fort until Duke Harless reaches us. At the same time, this is obviously a coordinated pincer movement. They intend to come at us from both sides at once, and I doubt they do it at all unless they figured out they had the numbers to get the job done before the Duke gets here.
That assumes they know the Duke is coming. Father Naklos gave Kirbish a hard look.
If they're unaware he's marching to our relief, they're the ones who'll find themselves trapped between us and the army of Shiloh.
That's true, Father, Douglas Martin acknowledged. I suspect they do know, though. They certainly know about the attack on Thesmar, and whether we like it or not, their navy has free run of the sea. I'm no sailor, and I don't know how long it would take a ship from Thesmar to reach Trochinus, say. As soon as one did, though, the semaphore would tell the heretics the Duke's broken camp. It wouldn't take a genius to guess where he has to be headed. They may not know how many men he has, but I think we have to assume they do know he's on his way.
And so what do you recommend, Colonel? The underpriest's voice was unyielding. That we simply abandon our position?
I never said that, Father.
Martin's Southguard accent was a bit more pronounced than it had been, but he faced Von Hain without flinching.
I'm simply pointing out that whatever plans we make should be based on the most realistic assumptions about the enemy's strength and preparedness available to us. Assumptions which are too pessimistic will leave us half defeated before we even begin, but overly optimistic assumptions may prove even more dangerous.
Sula knows we've seen more than enough optimists get beat on the arse,
Colonel Helfred Valverday growled.
Nobody expected the heretic bastards to get in and burn Razor to the ground, now did they?
He glowered around the table. Half of Walker's militia consisted of the 3 regiments of Razor volunteers, which had been raised by the Shiloh faithful after the heretic raid on the town of the same name. Major Olivier Becht and Colonel Tobias Schrader, who commanded the 1st 2 regiments of volunteers, had at least some pre-rising militia experience. Valverday did not. He distinguished himself by his zeal in stamping out pockets of heresy around Razor, however, and a senior inquisitor had nominated him to command one of the new regiments. He was short on training in movement and tactics, and Walker was certain he'd be a disaster in an open field battle, but he was a ferocious disciplinarian, his men trusted him, and his lack of training would be a much less serious disadvantage defending a fortified position.
"I'm forced to agree with Colonel Martin and Colonel Valverde," Singleton said into the brief silence which followed. "At the same time, I'm afraid I have to point out that the enemy's cavalry strength appears to be at least 5 times our own, and their lead elements are already on the road between here and Karmic. Even if we wanted to abandon the fort, we'd have to fight our way through Carisian horse and foot, and they'd have the advantage in numbers."
A shiver ran down Walker's spine at that thought. He was inclined to think Singleton was overestimating the numbers of the enemy's horsemen, and he was overlooking the fact that the heretic's cavalry was split, with half of it trapped east of the Branath and Shingle Mountains. Yet if half the whispered tales about Carisian weapons capabilities were accurate, the thought of facing them in the open and probably outnumbered was one to chill the boldest heart. He looked around his office, seeing his own worry reflected in every other face, and realized where the conversation was going to end. It would take a while, yet the final decision was about as inevitable as decisions came.
"It's too bad the semaphore's down," he reflected unhappily. "I really would like to be able to tell Duke Harless how much we'd appreciate his getting here as quickly as possible."
Chapter 14. Karmic, the South March Lands, Republic of Sidermark.
"You do have a habit of turning up at opportune moments, don't you?" Duke Eastshear asked, looking up from the map on his folding desk with a smile, as Captain Brainair escorted Abraham Jevons into his tent. The Sage Inn looked as wet, muddy, and cold as anyone in Eastshear's column, but if it worried him, he hid it well.
"As Major Thrawis would say, one tries, Your Grace," he replied with a slight bow.
"May I assume you and your colleagues have fresh information about Fort Terris for me?"
"At least some."
Jevons accepted a mug of hot apple cider from Corporal Chalkier.
"Not as much as I'm sure you'd like, I'm afraid."
"Show me a general with all the information he wants, and I'll show you an idiot,"
Eastshear said tartly, and Jevons chuckled.
"It's a little better than that, Your Grace." The Sage Inn sipped appreciatively, then lowered the mug. "Our best estimate is that they have somewhere over 19,000 men inside their perimeter now that those Razor volunteers have come in. Kerbish has made his regiment almost up to full strength, too, but Singleton's managed to lose a couple of hundred more cavalry, mostly by doing stupid things in this kind of weather." Eastshear grimaced. Thanks to Jevons' associates, he had far better information on the opposing commanders than he'd had any right to expect. Colonel Clarake Singleton was young for his rank and responsibilities, little more than 30. On the other hand, Major Robert Timmons, who commanded the 2nd Provisional Cavalry Regiment, which had been attached to Eastshear's brigade, was even younger, probably no older than Emperor Caleb himself. And whereas Singleton had started out with 1,800 men and was down to no more than 1,000 after operational losses, Timmons had started out with barely 500 and was now up to over 2,000 despite operational losses. Part of that was courtesy of the cavalry mounts Eastshear's men had captured from Catesworth, but more importantly, Timmons understood horses were actually fragile creatures. Properly cared for, they were capable of amazing endurance. Casually or poorly cared for, they broke down and died with appalling speed.
"Well, Major Timmons has reported the rebel cavalry isn't pressing his men very hard," the Duke observed dryly. "If Singleton's managed to turn that many of his troopers into infantry, we know why, don't we?"
"Yes, we do," Jevons agreed and sipped more cider. "On the other hand, cavalry probably won't be very useful once you and General Willis get down to business."
"True." Eastshear nodded, then frowned as he listened to the galloping patter of raindrops on the canvas overhead.
"It's going to be muckier and muddier than I'd anticipated, though, and I'm sure the fatigue parties will curse my name more inventively than Clinton. But if we've got a couple of 5 days to work with..."
"I can't make any guarantees," Jevons said,
But I will say I'd be absolutely astonished if Harless was able to get his vanguard here any time within the next 3-5 days. And if he hears about an attack on Fort Terrace, and he's smart enough to strip off Alvarez and send him ahead? The Dalarans could cut that by a good 5 day, Jevons acknowledged. From his record to date, though, the thought won't even occur to him. I'd like to think you're right about that, but is even he really that stupid? It's not actually stupidity, Your Grace. Jevons cradled his mug in both hands and frowned down into it, like a man seeking exactly the words he wanted. It's more blindness and blinkers than outright stupidity, he said finally. Harless isn't an imaginative man. There's no doubt about that. Worse, he knows what he knows that he knows, as Master Hausman might put it, and he's not about to chase any wild wyverns into the unknown as long as the methods he knows are working. And the problem he has right now is that they are working. Eastchair looked at him in disbelief, and the Sejin snorted. Oh, they aren't working by your standards, Your Grace, or by the Republic's, or by the Army of Guards, for that matter. But they're working as well as the Imperial Desnarian Army's methods have traditionally worked, and that's the yardstick he's using. That's where his lack of imagination comes in. He hasn't had Alvarez's experience, and because he's insisted on leading the entire march from Thesmar with his own troops, he truly doesn't realize how much faster Alvarez could be moving, even in this weather, without the rest of the army of Shiloh in the way. He'd like to get to Fort Terrace sooner, and he's frustrated by how long it's taking, but he genuinely thinks he's getting there as quickly as he can, and the truth is that he's pushing his own baggage train and men hard enough to take significant losses from straggling. Eastshire's expression shifted slowly from disbelief to thoughtfulness. Then he nodded. You may have a point. In fact, now that you've explained it, I think you do. But even if you do, I'm not making any comfortable assumptions about his, what was it you called them? Blindness and blinkers, was it? The Duke's forefinger tapped his map, tracing the line of the high road through the Kiplinger Forest, the broad swath of unconsecrated native Safeholdian forest between Karmic and Roymark. I think we'll just put some good cavalry scouts out this way, and maybe a company or two of scout snipers in among the trees. If His Grace of Harless's imagination is underdeveloped, I think the least we can do is stretch it for him, don't you? Chapter 15. Fort Terrace, Shiloh Province, Republic of Sidermark. Well, that's confirmed, Colonel Kurbish said sourly. He and Michael Jameson stood on the muddy summit of an earthen embankment, watching scattered horsemen drift towards them. All of Cleric Singleton's remaining cavalry were safely within Fort Terrace's defenses. That didn't leave much doubt about who the newcomers had to be, and the rain had eventually stopped, at least briefly. The better visibility made it obvious the oncoming cavalry was Sidermarkian, but Kurbish's prized spyglass had verified that the infantry column slogging up the muddy track on its heels wore the mottled uniforms which could only belong to Carizian regulars. Could be worse. Jameson's tone was equally sour. It could be Carizians on both sides of the damned mountains. Kurbish grunted and wondered again if Walkier was truly fool enough to attempt to hold the entire area he'd fortified. To be fair, throwing up the earthworks had given his regiment something to do besides sit around and worry. And he had laid out his outer perimeter in the assumption that when the army of Shiloh arrived to relieve him, it would want a large, well-fortified position here in O'Hotland's Gap. But surely he had to realize the position was far too large for the forces under his command to man adequately. Oh, the entrenchments were certainly impressive, with each parapet fronted by a deep ditch and covered by a thick abattis. Most of the ditches were knee-deep, or even waist-deep in water, thanks to the rain, and they'd done their best to provide overhead cover for the firing steps. If they'd just had the men to man them, they would have been a formidable obstacle. Unfortunately, they didn't have the men, and the heretics' simultaneous arrival at the eastern and western ends of the gap made a bad situation even worse.
"I'll bet you we're actually close to even in manpower," Kurbish thought bitterly. "And according to what they've always told me in the militia, that means the defenders should have the advantage."
"Yeah, sure."
He glowered some more. It seemed to be a given that they'd have to mount at least a token defense of the outer works, although he hoped to Langhorne Walkyear would settle for holding the second line of defenses rather than the first. Even the second line was 52 miles long, but a 25% reduction was nothing to sneer at. For that matter, the road, and the only way through the gap for anything larger than a cliff lizard, ran directly through Fort Terrace, and the line of works protecting the fort itself was only 10 miles long.
"Of course, we used up all those nice abatis on the first and second lines, didn't we? Still, getting the frontage down to 3 feet per man would be Schuler's own improvement on damn near 20 feet per man."
It struck him as a bad sign that Walkyear still hadn't decided, or bothered to tell his commanders at any rate, which of the several defensive plans they'd discussed he intended to follow. Those Carisian heretics weren't wasting any time, judging by the speed of their marching columns, and if they guessed how thinly stretched Fort Terrace's garrison was, they might just throw an assault straight at the entrenchments.
"And it shouldn't take a military genius to figure out how thinly we're stretched now, should it?"
"We can't hold the outer lines, Michael," he said flatly. "If we try, we'll get reamed. We may actually outnumber the bastards, but if we spread out to cover everything, they'll hit us at 9 or 10 to 1 odds at a point of their own choosing and smash right through us."
"Wish I could disagree,"
Colonel Zomson growled after a moment.
"Happen you're right, though."
He showed his teeth.
"For a militia officer, you've your head screwed on better than quite a few regulars, I could mention. The question is whether we ask for orders or use our initiative,"
Kurbish pointed out, glancing at the heliograph 50 feet east of their current position. Under the plan for defending the entire position, he and Zomson were responsible for the 30 miles of entrenchment directly threatened by the Carisians' arrival. Since they had roughly 4,000 men between them, that meant each of their men had to cover only 15 yards or so of frontage, unless, of course, they wanted to retain a useful reserve for some silly reason. Somehow that struck him as a losing proposition. Unfortunately, he wasn't at all certain how General Walkyear would respond to a militarily correct request for permission to fall back. If Father Naklos happened to be standing at the general's shoulder when the request arrived, the decision time would probably double, however. Much as Kurbish respected the priest's bright, searing faith, there was no point pretending von Hain was anything like flexible. Indeed, that faith of his made him even less flexible when it came to anything that resembled giving ground before the heretical apostate foes of Mother Church. No doubt that helped account for all Father Naklos had managed to accomplish, but it wasn't always a useful character trait. Zomson was clearly uncomfortable at the notion of withdrawing without authorization. His regiment was built out of the remnants of 3 regiments which had suffered massive casualties during the Rising, and he'd done well hammering them into a cohesive unit. Despite that, there was a reason he'd been old for his rank before the Rising. No one could ever accuse him of doing an inch less than his very best, yet he'd always been more of a stolid, slogging, stubborn fighter than a thinker. He wasn't stupid, however, and he too glanced at the heliograph, then inhaled deeply.
"Something your very first sergeant teaches you is that there's times it's easier to beg forgiveness than ask permission, Brian. I'm thinking this here's one of those very times."
His unhappiness was obvious, but there was no hesitation in his brown eyes.
"If we're minded to pull back without disordering our companies, we'd best get started soon."
"Pull back to our secondary positions, you think?"
Kurbish asked, suddenly aware of how grateful he was for Zomson's bluff, unimaginative presence.
"At least,"
Zomson's voice was flat,
I'm thinking it'd be best to fall back all the way to the third line, truth to tell.
We'd be giving up the hills on either side to the heretics' artillery. That might not be a very good idea if half the stories about those new model guns of theirs are true, Kurbish pointed out, and Zomsen made a sound somewhere between a laugh, a grunt, and a curse.
If they can get guns up there, happen they can get them up on the flanks of the outer works, too. And if they get eyes up there and see how thin the outer works are held, happen we're screwed come what may, as I'm thinking you just pointed out.
Actually, I believe I did. Kurbish considered for a moment. I think we should fall back to the second line, send a runner to General Walkyr to tell him what we're doing, and ask if he wants to consider shortening our line still farther. If we get started now, we can probably pull the guns back without too much trouble. And, he very carefully did not say out loud, considering the 6 miles or so between their present position and Walkyr's office, if we've already started the guns moving before our runner gets to Walkyr, and he can get a message back to us, it'll be far too dangerous to turn them back around and risk getting our artillery caught by a sudden heretic rush while we're trying to re-emplace it.
I'm thinking that's a very good point, Colonel Kurbish,
Zomsen said dryly, an unusual gleam of amusement lighting his eye.
In fact, I'm thinking we'd best get right on that. Immediately.
So do I, Colonel Zomsen. Kurbish smiled. So do I.
Too bad they were smart enough to pull back after all, Your Grace,
Brigadier George Mikeson grimaced.
Now, now, George, Duke Eastshire's tone was gently reproving. You know these people really aren't Catesworth.
They stood atop what had been the outermost parapet of the Fort Terrace position in the foothills southwest of the fortress. It was just under 3 miles to the next earthen berm, which said quite a lot about how ambitious Walkyr's plans had been, and he studied the inner works through his double glass while they spoke.
And fair's fair. They never expected to get hit from both sides simultaneously.
Well, with all due respect, Your Grace, they damned well should have considered it when they laid out this abortion.
Mikeson shook his head in disgust.
It's not just too damned big to hold with the troops they've got. Most of it's in the wrong damned place. And half, hell, 2/3 of the outer works can be dominated by artillery in the hills.
True. Eastshire lowered his double glass to smile at his senior field commander. On the other hand, you've been thinking about modern artillery for years now. These people have never even seen a new model piece. Hard to blame them for thinking in terms of obsolete monsters like the ones in their own positions. Mikeson glowered some more. He'd started as an engineer himself, and he was clearly disinclined to make any concessions where the stupidity of the rebels' engineers were concerned.
At any rate, the Duke continued in a grimmer tone, the outer works don't matter, and never did. But that innermost ring around the fort itself could be a pain. I think they'll at least try to hold the third line, but that won't last for long. Then we'll be up against entrenchments they've got almost enough men to man. And once we get past them, we're up against the original fortifications, because there's no way around them. Unlike the rest of this abortion, you called it, wasn't it? The fort's actually in the right spot to defend what needs to be defended. Worse, whoever designed it knew what he was doing, and we'll be pushing them back into it. If they had any sense, that's where they'd be already.
Can't you, Grace?
Mikeson countered respectfully. Eastshire cocked an eyebrow at him, and the brigadier shrugged.
Caught betwixt and between is what they are. Too many men to squeeze into the original fort. Too few to hold the entrenchments outside it. They try to pull everybody back inside, they'll be like sardines in a jar, and us putting angle gun shells and mortar rounds right in amongst them. Don't think they'd like that above half.
Eastshire nodded slowly. Mikeson might well be right, although he still anticipated a nasty tussle. If there was time, Colonel Rymon's Glacier Heart miners would undoubtedly prove their worth. But if it took that long, even Harless might get here in time to raise the siege.
Well, in that case, I suppose we'd best get the artillery up. We'll start by seeing how serious they are about holding the second line,
And I think, if we can convince them not to, we might be able to get the 4 inches up on those hills east of the fort. The Duke smiled thinly. The men who designed that fort didn't know new model artillery was coming either. They never imagined that someone might actually be able to get guns up there, or that they'd have the range to reach the walls if somebody did manage it. I think we should see about taking advantage of that, don't you?
Aye, Your Grace, that I do.
I think we'll use the 6th for security on the guns. 1 battalion should be more than enough against anything this lot might get up to. We'll use the 5th to man the front line, and Lutelo's other 3 battalions will form our reserve.
Sounds reasonable, Mikeson said. Might want a company or two of young Timon's cavalry in reserve, too.
He hawked and spat on the ground.
Don't think much of this Singleton, but I suppose even he might get up to mischief if the crack he's in is deep enough.
So he might, Eastshire agreed. All right, I'll leave all of that in your hands, George, but please tell Colonel Markin I'll be sending Lewis to make contact with General Willis, and I want a squad of his scout snipers to make sure he gets there safely. It'll probably be another hour or two before he's ready to go, but since they've pulled back and left us these lovely mucky hillsides and lizard paths, we might as well make use of them. Which is why I also want Lewis and his keepers to keep an eye out for likely semaphore positions along the way.
Aye, Your Grace,
the Brigadier repeated, and Eastshire nodded in satisfaction. 1st Brigade was Markin's command, and the Duke had never been inclined to snatch the reins out of a perfectly competent subordinate's hands. In that case, he started down the muddy face of the abandoned earthwork towards his horse. It's all yours. I'd expect a progress report in a few hours.
Aye, you'll have it.
I know I will, George. Eastshire paused to smile. It just eases my mind to hear my own voice saying it.
They shouldn't have pulled back so quickly,
Father Niklos von Hain growled.
We shouldn't have given up the outer works without at least some fight, not after spending so much effort building them.
He and Larrae's Walkier sat in the general's office as darkness closed down, sharing a pot of something the cooks called tea. They'd run out of hot chocolate months ago, and the last of the real tea had gone the same way shortly before word of the heretic's impending arrival reached Fort Terrace. The beverage Walker's cook had provided as a substitute was hot, but that was about all anyone could say in its favor. Von Hain suspected it had been made using either burnt breadcrumbs or ground acorns, and he'd firmly resolved not to ask which. Walker took a long, slow sip of tea while he weighed his intendant's complaint. Part of him agreed with Von Hain. Another part, which he suspected was the smarter part of him, agreed with Kerbish and Zomsen. Yet Von Hain had been his spiritual guide and closest advisor from the very first day of the Rising. At the very least, he deserved the careful consideration of his views.
"Under most circumstances, I'd agree with you, Father,"
he said finally, setting the cup on its saucer. He cut a sliver of cheese from the only slightly moldy wedge on the corner of his desk, one of the last cheeses of the winter before, and tore a piece of bread from the still warm loaf beside it. "But most circumstances would have included being attacked from only one direction at a time," he continued. "And, to be honest, Kerbish was right. If he and Zomsen had stayed put and let the heretics throw an assault column at them, the result would have been a disaster."
"But they had the earthworks and the abattoir."
Von Hain's tone was less angry, although he clearly wasn't quite ready to give up.
"That would have made up for a lot, Larrae's."
"Not enough." Walker took a bite of bread and cheese, chewed slowly, and washed it down with another swallow of so-called tea, then shrugged. "The heretics would have controlled the point at which they attacked, Father, but Kerbish and Zomsen would have been forced to defend the entire wall. That would spread their men so thinly, the heretics could easily have attacked at 20 or 30 to 1 odds just by picking their spots. I'm sure our men would have fought hard, but against those odds?" He shook his head.
I won't pretend I wasn't pissed off when they took it upon themselves to pull back, but that doesn't make it the wrong decision. In fact, I'm not planning on putting anything but pickets on the second line either. Von Hayne stared at him, and Walkyear gave him a lopsided smile. Father, there's a reason they put Fort Terrace where they put it. As long as we're sitting here on the road, nobody's getting past us. They may be able to send small parties on foot through the foothills, may even be able to get some cavalry through there, whatever Singleton says about impassable terrain, but they can't get transport wagons or artillery across those lizard paths. So when you come down to it, the fort and the earthworks right around it are all that really matters. But, forgive me, Lerys, but it sounds as if you've already decided to stand solely on the defensive. Isn't that a recipe for ultimate defeat? Trying to launch sorties or fight them in the open would be a recipe for immediate defeat, Walkyear said, somewhat more firmly, almost harshly, than he normally spoke to the Schulerite. They have rifles and these new model guns of theirs. Our men have matchlocks, arbalists, and pikes. You read the reports of what the Dolorans did to the Fort Sheldon garrison, and we're talking about Carizians with those damned breech-loading rifles. Von Hayne's eyes fell. There had been so many reports, so many stories, carried by word of mouth or even transmitted by the semaphore, that it had become increasingly difficult to separate fact from fiction, rumor and invention from reality. Nonetheless, they'd been forced to accept that the Carizian heretics truly did possess breech-loading rifles capable of preposterous rates of fire. Leaving that aside, trying to defend the second line of entrenchments would be almost as bad as trying to defend the first one. We just don't have enough men to man the works. We never did, not out of our own resources, and we both knew that all along. So, we leave pickets to keep the heretics from just sashaying right across the parapet, but those pickets will skedaddle, as Colonel Valverday would put it, as soon as the heretics mount any serious attack. And then we concentrate on holding the core of our position, stuck right here in the heretic's throat, until the army of Shiloh gets here. At that point, the heretics west of the gap can either run or die, and Duke Harless will pass straight through and kick the asses of the bastards on the other side of the mountains as well. All we have to do is hold until he gets here. If we do that, we win. If we don't do that, the heretics win, and Mother Church and the Archangels lose Shiloh after all. It's that simple. However inglorious just hunkering down to hold may seem. Von Hayne looked back up, considering his protege's expression, the steadiness of his eyes, and realized Walkyear was right. And he also sensed a fresh resolution, an aura of determination. It was as if the moment of decision had refined Lerys Walkyear, and the priest remembered the army captain who'd led the seizure of Fort Terrace in the first place. That captain had been certain of his duty, unhesitating in its execution, and fierce in his devotion. Perhaps he'd been wrong to insist Walkyear accept promotion, the priest thought. It had seemed the right, the inevitable thing at the time, but now he wondered. The responsibilities that came with his new rank, the uncertainties of holding an isolated position without knowing when or if the promised relief column would arrive had been more than Walkyear had bargained for. The administrative details of somehow feeding his own command, organizing and helping to equip the militia, providing support for the faithful partisans, harrying the heretics, and doing his best to provide what little semblance of governance and order Western Shiloh had possessed— all those things had weighed down upon him because, whether he'd ever have admitted it or not, and he wouldn't, Von Hayne thought, because it would have been a sign of weakness, he'd been unsuited for that task. That, Von Hayne suddenly realized, was the true reason he'd kept his troops busy building such outsized fortifications, not simply so they'd be available when the army of Shiloh finally arrived, but to keep them— and him,
occupied doing something they understood. But now all those details, all those worries, had been swept aside, replaced by a single overpowering imperative. It was time once more to fight or die as God's own champion. And that, unlike administrative details and grand strategy, was something Larais Walkyr understood just fine.
The only way the heretics will pry him out of this position is by carrying him out dead, Von Hain realized. And when you come down to it, what more can Mother Church, or God, ask of any man? All right, Larais, he said gently. I understand. So while you concentrate on holding the position, I'll just have a word with the archangels to see if they can't speed Duke Harless on his way a bit.
Chapter 16 Malacton, on the Cherrick-Carmick High Road, the South Marchlands, Republic of Sidermark.
And I'm afraid I have to insist on disturbing him anyway, Sir Graham, Sir Reynos Alvarez said flatly. I apologize for interrupting his supper, but this is something which won't keep.
Sir Graham Keir glowered at Alvarez, permitting his brown eyes to show just a trace of aristocratic contempt for the other man's sodden, mud-splashed appearance. Alvarez experienced a sudden, overwhelming desire to punch the youthful Baron of Fearnock in the eye, then kick him in the belly when he went down. Followed up by a boot heel to the Adam's apple, preferably, or at least a good solid kick in the testicles. No, better the Adam's apple. He'd probably survive a kick in the balls, however satisfying that might be. No doubt a proper Desnarian nobleman would have thought in terms of a formal duel, but allowing the little bastard that much dignity was more than Alvarez cared to contemplate.
"As I've explained, Sir Reynos," Fearnock began, "my uncle, that is, His Grace," he smiled thinly, "is at table. As soon as
I..."
Alvarez's tone turned suddenly to precise, icy steel.
"Command the Dalaran contingent of the army of Shiloh. I answer to Mother Church and to my king, not to you, my lord. If I'm not in Duke Harless's presence within the next 2 minutes, my command and I will be headed back to Thesmar within the next 12 hours. The explanation for why that happened will be that you were too arrogant, too pig-headed, and too fucking stupid to allow me to speak to him on a matter of the greatest urgency, clearly demonstrating that it was impossible to coordinate properly with your granduncle since he was willing to tolerate your stupidity. And, my Lord Baron, I will personally guarantee that the Inquisition will be discussing with you exactly why you personally sabotaged the campaign Mother Church has ordered this army to undertake. I'm certain Emperor Maris will wish to discuss it with your granduncle as well."
He pulled out his watch and snapped the cover open.
"You now have 1 minute and 50 seconds, my lord."
Fearnock stared at him, his face first turning dark with fury and then bone white with terror. He opened his mouth and,
1 minute and 40 seconds, Alvarez said in that same deadly voice. "I wouldn't waste any of them talking to me if I were you."
Fearnock shut his mouth with an almost audible click, then darted out of the vestibule of the mayor of Malacton's house, which he'd appropriated in Harless's name, as soon as the vanguard reached the town. The door closed sharply behind him, and Alvarez heard someone inhaling through his teeth and glanced up from his watch at Captain Latimer.
"Yes, Lincoln?" he asked pleasantly.
"Did my heart good, sir. You do realize you've just made an enemy for life, though, don't you?"
"I suppose I have. Frankly, I've never met anyone I'd rather have as an enemy. The way he's handled access to his precious uncles cost this army at least 5,000 stragglers since we left Thesmar, and according to Master Slatier here," he nodded to the very tall, grey-haired, brown-eyed man standing behind the two Dalarans and maintaining a prudent silence, "the pair of them may have cost us Fort Terrace as well.
His nostrils flared.
I'm pretty much out of patience where that little son of a bitch is concerned.
Captain Latimer nodded, although a certain trepidation still shadowed his expression. It wasn't for himself, however, and he straightened as Baron Fearnock rematerialized.
His Grace will see you immediately, Sir Reynos, he said with awful, frigid dignity and a dagger-eyed promise of retribution.
Thank you. Alvarez snapped his watch closed and returned it deliberately to his pocket, then twitched his head at Latimer and Slater.
A moment, Sir Reynos. I cannot admit anyone but yourself to His Grace's presence,
Fearnock said quickly, with an unpleasant smile. Alvarez considered him for a moment, then turned and seated himself on one of the stools normally used by couriers waiting to deliver messages to Harless's subordinates.
If you can't admit all three of us to his presence, we'll await him here, he said evenly. Understanding, I trust, that the same conditions and time limit apply to his appearance here. The choice is yours, my lord.
Fearnock glared at him, one hand clenching on his dagger, and Alvarez looked back, cold-eyed as a serpent, and tugged the watch back out of his pocket. He started to reopen the cover, but Fearnock's nostrils flared. His handsome face wasn't particularly handsome at the moment. Puce was not a becoming color, as he jerked his head back the way he'd come.
Very well, Sir Reynos.
He bit each syllable out of bone and bile.
If you and your companions would step this way.
Of course. Alvarez stood and nodded to the two men at his back. Lincoln, Master Slate here,
I believe we're expected.
Duke Harless looked considerably less furious than Alvarez had anticipated. Perhaps the young idiot had been wise enough to keep his ultimatum to himself. If so, he was at least a little brighter than Alvarez had thought. Given his record, that was hard to believe. On the other hand, he could scarcely be less bright. The lamplit dining room was warm, unlike the raw, wet night. A fire crackled cheerfully on its hearth, and Harless and his companions were dressed in the height of court fashion. Obviously, they'd found the time for hot baths and a fresh change of clothing, even if none of their shivering, sodden troopers could say the same.
Sir Reynos, the Duke nodded, not exactly curtly, but not with any effusion of joy, and remained seated.
That might not have been entirely out of irritation at having been disturbed, however. Judging from the empty bottles standing sentinel among the remnants of enough food to feed an entire squad of his ravenous army, he might not have been capable of rising.
I understand this is a matter of some urgency.
It is, Your Grace.
Alvarez bowed in formal greeting to Harless, Father Timothy Yerden, Earl Hankey, and Earl Hennett. The Schulerite intendant looked distinctly glassy-eyed, although Hankey and Hennett appeared sober enough.
May we know what that matter is?
Harless's words came a trifle more slowly than usual, but without slurring or hesitation.
Master Slater, Alvarez beckoned to the tall Sidermarkian, and Slater stepped forward. Your Grace, this is Master Zepith Slater. He comes to us from Shiloh Province.
Harless's expression didn't change for a moment. Then his eyes narrowed.
Shiloh Province, he repeated more sharply, and Alvarez nodded. One of my cavalry units picked him up on his way to us, he said,
deliberately not noting the quick flicker of anger in Earl Hennett's eyes. Harless's cavalry commander deeply resented Alvarez's unilateral decision to send three regiments of his own cavalry to join the mounted force screening the rest of the sluggishly crawling army. Not that there'd been much he could do about it, since he was the one who'd refused any suggestion that all of the cavalry might be merged into a single force. Alvarez wasn't about to pretend he was unhappy over Hennett's decision. In fact, he'd made the suggestion in the devout hope that the arrogant Earl would do just that. Because Hennett had gratified his hope, the army's Dalaran cavalry was Alvarez's to use as he chose.
and what he chose was to send out a cavalry screen in whose scouting ability he reposed some faith. And if it could just happen to be present when Desnarian foraging parties descended upon some isolated farmstead whose owners hadn't fled in time, so much the better. Alvarez never doubted his men would steal anything that wasn't nailed down, and anything that was nailed down if they had time to pry it loose, but he also knew they would prevent the outrages, ranging from simple assaults all the way to rape and murder, Harless's foragers committed all too often out of the ancient hostility between Desnair and Siddermark. That was another reason Hennet resented his decision so bitterly, and the Earl had ordered his own troopers to make damned sure the Dalarans didn't embarrass them and him by reporting anything they missed. Which meant, given that his so-called scouts outnumbered Alvarez's by something like 50-1, that he couldn't be pleased that Slatyr had passed entirely through his cavalry without being spotted. Pity about that.
"Did they indeed?" Harless asked softly.
"Indeed." Alvarez nodded.
"He bears a message from General Walker. Master Slatyr?"
The muddy, wet Slatyr reached into his battered belt pouch and withdrew a letter. The wafer which had sealed it had been broken, and he looked at Alvarez for a moment. The Dalaran twitched his head in Harless's direction, and Slatyr handed it across. The rhythm of rain beating on the roof and tapping against the windows was the only sound, except the rustle of paper, as Harless tilted the letter to catch the light and squinted at it. Reading was not his favorite pastime, nor was Walker's penmanship of the best, and his eyes moved slowly. Then his face tightened abruptly. His eyes moved faster, reached the end, and lifted to glare first at Slatyr and then at Alvarez, as if the two of them might have been personally responsible for its contents.
"Is this true?"
he demanded of the Siddermarkian, his voice harsh.
"Wouldn't know, my lord," Slatyr replied, in the slow, almost musical accent of Shiloh. He was well into middle age, his hair gray, his eyes a muddy brown. His knuckles were a bit swollen with arthritis, and his shoulders, despite his impressive height, stooped. He favored his right leg when he walked as well, and there was an air of near exhaustion about him, but there was no hesitation in his expression as he met Harless's gaze.
"Haven't read it myself, General Walker. He said deliver it, and so I done. Didn't ask what it said, and he didn't say."
Alvarez's lips twitched at Harless's expression, but he called them firmly to order.
"Very well," Harless said, passing the letter to Yerdon. "Let me phrase it a different way. According to this letter, the heretics have placed Fort Terris under siege."
Hennet, Hankey, and even Firnak stiffened.
"Of your knowledge, Master Slatyr, was it?"
The Siddermarkian nodded.
"Very well, Master Slatyr. Is that true?"
"Truer than death, my lord," Slatyr said flatly. "Got a great fuck... a right smart-sized army at each end of the gap, they do. And I could hear them guns of theirs a-firin' while I rode away."
"He estimates the heretic's strength at perhaps 20,000,
Harless said, darting a quick glance at Alvarez.
"Would you say that's accurate?"
"No, that's more than I could be guessing."
Slatyr was obviously unafraid to admit ignorance, Alvarez noted, and more power to him.
"All I can tell you is that one batch of 'em come down the Branagh Canal, and the other come by road, down by way of Maidenburg. I seen a parcel of 'em a-coming in both directions when I lit out to find you 7 days agone, and if'n they was sheep or cows, or maybe dragons, might be I could see how many there was."
He shrugged.
"Not so good at counting soldiers, I'm afraid, my lord."
Siddermarkians had no noblemen of their own, and weren't much given to deferring to anyone else's, especially Desnarians.
They certainly weren't interested in the proper modes of address for them, and Slater's generic "milord" actually represented quite a concession for him or his countrymen. Alvarez normally found that attitude moderately irritating, but not this time. In point of fact, the anger in Fearnok's eyes as Slater failed to abase himself properly before his granduncle's towering nobility gave Alvarez a profound sense of satisfaction. Slater's news grew no sweeter each time he heard it, however.
"And why did General Walker select you as his messenger?"
Harless inquired, as a marginally less tipsy-looking Father Timothy passed the dispatch on to Earl Hankey.
"Instead of one of his own men, I mean."
"Didn't explain everything to me, my lord, but I'm a-guessing 'twas because them cavalry of his can't find their arses with both hands come to ride in the hills."
Slater shrugged.
"Me? I grew up in 'em, man and boy. Know 'em like I used to know my wife. Probably figured I might get through. I knew damned well they wouldn't. Not with them soldiers in the funny-coloured uniforms a-swarming around. Seemed to know what they was about, they did, if you take my meaning. Had to move right smart getting past 'em. Damn near caught me time or two."
Harless stiffened at the confirmation that the heretic forces west of Fort Terrace were, indeed, Carizian regulars. He looked back at Hankey and Hennett, his color ashen in the lamplight, then back at Slater.
"Thank you, Master Slater," he made himself say. "Baron Fearnok will find you a place to sit out of the wet and something to eat. I'll ask you to wait there in case we have additional questions for you."
Slater nodded amiably in an even more flagrant display of the Sidermarkian disregard for noble blood and followed a stiff-backed Fearnok from the mayor's dining room. Harless watched them go, then drew a deep breath and gestured at an empty chair at the table.
"Please be seated, Serenos. It would seem you were quite correct to bring this to my attention immediately."
"Excuse me, sir,"
Sir Lincoln Latimer said cautiously as he rode through the rain, more of a blowing mist than a downpour at the moment, at Alvarez's side. They were headed back out of town, towards the Dalaran encampment and Alvarez's tent.
"Yes, Lincoln?"
Alvarez's tone was courteous, but Latimer heard an echo of his superior's stiff posture and stiffer expression in its depths.
"I'm sorry, sir."
The captain picked his words carefully. He'd been banished from his superior's meeting by a flick of Father Timothy's hand, probably to prevent him from observing the degree of the priest's inebriation.
"But you seem less than pleased with the result of your conference with Duke Harless."
"Indeed?" Alvarez shrugged.
"That's because I am less than pleased."
"But didn't His Grace—" "No, His Grace didn't." Alvarez cut him off abruptly, something he rarely did.
"I asked, I begged, Shan Wei, I pleaded for him to let me take our troops ahead. He refused. Because the troops between us and Fort Terrace appear to be Carizians, he fears that their artillery and those breech-loading rifles of theirs would give them too great an advantage for us to encounter without Desnarian support." "Support!"
Alvarez was so furious he actually spat, and Latimer flinched.
"It pains me more than you can possibly guess, Lincoln,"
his general continued after a moment, his voice filled with broken bits of iron.
"But I'm coming to the conclusion that I owe that bastard Thirsk an apology."
Latimer blinked in astonishment, ambushed by the sudden, totally unanticipated segue, and Alvarez chuckled sourly, even though he couldn't possibly have seen his aides blink in the darkness.
"I don't imagine you expected to hear that out of me,"
he continued in a marginally less bitter voice.
"But the truth is that my cousin Fidel wasn't a sailor, and was a stubborn man. All these years I've blamed Thirsk, the experienced sailor, the man who was frigging well supposed to know what the Navy was doing, for not giving him the advice he was entitled to, and then blaming the entire disaster on him. After all, he should have kept Fidel from making so many mistakes, shouldn't he? That was what he was there for. And then he lost his own part of the fleet after he abandoned Fidel, didn't he? He fell silent for a moment, then inhaled sharply, the sound audible over the wet clopping of their horses' hooves. "Now I know exactly how Thirst must have felt," he grated. "I gave them my best advice. I argued myself blue in the face. I all but got down on my knees to that stiff-necked, arrogant Desnarian prick, and I might as well have saved my breath. If that's what Thirst went through with Fidel, and as much as I hate to admit it, it damned well could be, I've been blaming the wrong idiot for what happened to the Navy off Armageddon Reef."
Vladimir's amazement could scarcely have been greater if Langhorne in all his glory had appeared out of the rainy dark in front of him. Instinct suggested that saying anything of the sort would be a serious tactical error, however.
"So, what is the Duke going to do, sir?" he asked instead.
"He agrees time is of the essence. And he also acknowledges that the army has made less than its best speed, because we've been unavoidably delayed by the unanticipated bad weather since leaving Thesmar." The irony in his tone was withering, and Vladimir understood it perfectly. Malakton was almost 500 miles from Fort Terrace. At the Army of Shiloh's present rate of advance, it would take them 5 days to cover that distance. Alvarez's troops could have made the same march in less than 3, even in this weather. For that matter, they could already have been in Fort Terrace, left to their own devices.
"In light of the emergency at Fort Terrace, however," Alvarez continued, "the entire army will set out tomorrow to force march to General Walker's relief. He believes we should be able to increase our speed by as much as 50%.
Vladimir's jaw tightened. At that rate, it would still take them 14 days to cover the distance, and that was assuming the accursed heretics didn't do little things like burning or blowing up bridges or dropping cut trees across the road once they were into the Kiplinger Forest.
"And that, Lincoln," his general said, "constitutes Duke Harless's and Father Timothy's response to the news."
He did, however, send word to Walker that help is on its way. Master Slatier's already left.
"Master Slatier? By himself, sir?"
Surprise startled the question out of Vladimir, and Alvarez laughed harshly.
"Master Slatier made it past the heretics and that ass Hennett's cavalry with General Walker's dispatch and covered 500 miles in less than 8 days. Obviously, he's the best choice to return with Duke Harless's response."
Vladimir stared at him in the darkness, temporarily bereft of speech, as he recalled Slater's obvious exhaustion, and Alvarez shrugged.
"In fairness to the Duke, Slater didn't argue. In fact, I think he's got the measure of Earl Hennett's men and figures he's a lot more likely to get through by himself, without still more cavalry that can't find its arse with both hands. And judging from what I've seen of Master Slate here, I'm pretty sure he's right."
Vladimir nodded slowly, and they rode on into the blowing rain. Several miles to the east, Japheth Slate here rode in the opposite direction on a fresh, borrowed horse. His hair was noticeably less gray than it had been, and stubble seemed to be sprouting on his upper lip and chin at a remarkable rate. His shoulders were less stooped-looking as well, and the swollen knuckles and the age spots on the back of his hands had vanished. In fact, those hands looked considerably stronger and more sinewy than they had when he delivered the dispatch in Larrey's Walker's handwriting to Sir Reynos Alvarez and Duke Harless. He kept a close watch on his immediate surroundings through the snark floating overhead while he worked at putting at least a few miles between himself and Sir Reynos's reasonably competent cavalry screen before he summoned the recon skimmer. It was likely to take 2 or 3 hours, yet it was time he couldn't begrudge. Indeed, he was much more than simply satisfied, and any observer would have been struck by the gleam of amusement in the eyes which were no longer muddy or brown. Watching Alvarez pin back that little snot's ears was a joy to behold. Even for someone who's not all that fond of Dolorans, he thought. And sowing a little more discord in the enemy's camp can't hurt. Still, I wonder how Harless or that bastard Yerdan would have reacted if they'd realized they were in the presence of Demon Athrawis, his very self. Too bad I couldn't tell them. Or that Sladier couldn't give them a current update on the surprise young Rymon and his miners are about to give that bastard Walkier. A person, he reminded himself, couldn't have everything. Still, he wasn't going to pretend he hadn't been delighted by Walkier's failure to get a messenger of his own off to the army of Shiloh. That oversight had at least allowed him to amuse himself seeing to it that Duke Harless got the word after all. Seldom done a more satisfying day's work in my life, or Nemu's for that matter, he thought cheerfully, and started looking for a suitable place for the skimmer to collect him and his faithful mount.
Chapter 17. Archbishop's Palace, City of Monchir, Princedom of Coruscant.
Well, Archbishop Michael Stainer turned from the window looking out over the city of Monchir's Cathedral Square and smiled a bit crookedly at his host.
I must say it makes a change from my last visit, Claremont.
The square was a bustle with people, while Carisian merchant galleons lay to the quays and wharfs. A party of Carisian marines stood guard outside the house which had been the Carisian viceroy's mansion, was now the Carisian embassy, and would soon become the Coruscant headquarters of the Imperial Patent Office. Opposite the Archbishop's Palace, the Standard of the Air blew above Monchir Palace on one staff, flanked by two more, one flying the white crossed swords and orange field of Coruscant, the other a blue and white checkerboard quartered with black and charged with the golden kraken of Chorus.
"Quite a lot has changed since then, Your Eminence," Claremont Gerling agreed.
The Archbishop of Coruscant stepped to his superior's side, gazing out at the sunlit square pensively.
"I remember a discussion in this very palace with Bishop Gerald, a discussion of things I believed and things I suspected."
He shook his head.
"Many of those things I believed have been confirmed, to my joy."
He turned his head to look at Stainer.
"And so have most of those I suspected, to my sorrow."
"Clinton?"
Stainer's voice was soft, and Gerling nodded.
"And the others?"
His own voice was even softer.
"When he ordered Iris and Diven murdered, I knew I'd been right about who'd ordered Prince Hector's assassination as well. And I'd met both you and Emperor Caleb and Empress Charlian, and Sajan Merlin, for that matter. If I'd been inclined to doubt Earl Corus's evidence, the Temple's version of what happened in Delphirac would have convinced me. The men and the woman I'd met would never commit the acts of which you were accused. Almost worse, in some ways, if I'd ever needed proof that the rest of the group of four was just as complicit as he in the crimes he's committed in Mother Church's name, the fact that none of them challenged his lies provided it. And so, would I or wouldn't I had no choice but to become a full-fledged reformist and send the souls committed to my care to war against God's own church to save those very souls from God's own church."
"Forgive me," Stainer said gently, "but you've always been a reformist, Claremont. And in the end, which truly matters more, Mother Church or God? We've always taught, and been taught, there could be no division between them,"
Gerling replied, looking back out the window.
"But we've also always known that whatever Mother Church's origin, she's administered and governed by mortal men and women."
Stainer laid one large hand lightly on the younger Archbishop's shoulder.
"Mortals are fallible, my friend, even the best of us. And anything, be it ever so holy, governed by mortals, may also fail.
but Langhorn himself named Mother Church God's own instrument, the Grand Vicar, his inerrant voice, Gerling countered, his voice troubled.
No, Steinar corrected in that same gentle voice. He proclaimed the Holy Writ inerrant, but he proclaimed the Grand Vicar infallible when he spoke from Langhorn's own throne in accordance with the writ and God's will. That's an important qualification, you know, in accordance with the writ and God's will, because the writ itself teaches that even archangels proved fallible and corruptible in the end, does it not? If archangels can fall into the sin of setting their own wills, their own desires, before those of God, then surely a mere mortal, even the Grand Vicar, or those who control him, can do the same. And when that happens, he doesn't speak in accordance with God's will. I know. And I know too much of the history of Mother Church to be aware of other times her voice has been discordant. Yet I've always believed that while men might stray from the light, the Church would hold her true course, returning to it at his touch upon the helm when the wind blew her from it, that God would correct her when she strayed from his plan.
Perhaps that's what he's doing at this very moment, Steinar pointed out, and perhaps there's still more to his plan than we've discovered in the writ even yet.
Gerling turned his head, eyebrows rising, and Steinar smiled.
I have no new revelation to share with you at this moment, Claremont. Nor do I propose that you and I should go down to the cathedral and proclaim some genuine heresy just to satisfy Jaspar Clinton. But you know, God is omnipotent and omniscient, and you and I are neither of those things. I'm a good bit older than you, and one thing I've acquired over the years, along with rather more aches and pains than I wish I had, is the realization that God never stops teaching us about himself. We can close our eyes, we can shut our ears, we can pretend he's become silent over the centuries, speaking to us only through the writ, and no longer writing his words in our hearts as well. But when we do, we lie. We can refuse to learn. That doesn't stop him from teaching. And if we turn our backs on his lessons, we turn our backs on him as well. And that, Claremont, would be not simply a tragedy for us, but a sin against him. Our mortal limitations mean we can never truly and fully comprehend him, set a frame about him that limits him to that which we can perceive and conceptualize and describe in detail. Yet the fact that we can never fully comprehend him can never diminish the glory of what we can comprehend about him. Perhaps that's what's happening in the world today. The schism which has rent Mother Church represents more than mere mortal weakness and corruption. Perhaps God's chosen this moment to write his will across his creation in letters of fire that will ultimately teach us to know him even more deeply and truly.
Silence fell, burnished by the street sounds of Coruscant's capital, drifting through the opened window. It lingered, and then, finally, Gerling inhaled.
You may be right.
His voice was soft but firm, his dark eyes level as he met Steinar's gaze.
I'd never thought of it exactly that way, but surely the greatest sin a man or woman could commit would be to tell God what he can or cannot be, can or cannot do. All of us like to believe that had we been alive during the war against the fallen, we would have stood foursquare for the light, resolute and certain of our duty. No one could have led us astray. But much as we'd like to believe that, I suspect very few who live to see God working change at the moment of his choice recognize what they behold until the work is fully wrought. It may be we find ourselves in precisely that sort of time, yet how do we know?
We know by listening, not with our ears, but with this.
Steinar laid his palm flat on Gerling's chest.
We know by making the choices he sets before us as best we can, trusting him to guide us.
All of his children have to do that every day of their lives, Cramond. Should you and I, just because we wear archbishop's rings, be any different from all our other brothers and sisters in that regard?
He smiled, and his hand moved once more to the younger man's shoulder, shaking Gerling very gently.
As far as our flocks are concerned, you and I are among the world's great and powerful. Do you really feel that way in your own chapel when you open your heart? I think not. I think you already know exactly how he expects us to make our choices and our decisions. Perhaps I do.
Gerling raised his own hand to the one on his shoulder, and his eyes had turned warmer.
Perhaps I only needed you to remind me. I think you've been doing just fine without me around to play font of all wisdom.
Stainer's eyes twinkled, yet there was something like sorrow behind their amusement.
I don't know about you, but there are times I could wish I had fewer choices to deal with. And
the twinkle faded.
But the ones I make affected only myself, and not millions upon millions of his other children, living and yet unborn. Unfortunately, he can be rather insistent. Unreasonable of him, I know, but there it is. So I've found myself.
Gerling chuckled and squeezed the hand on his shoulder briefly.
You seem to be doing pretty well so far, however, Your Eminence. And I've heard this nagging voice nattering away in the back of my brain and my heart, telling me I'm supposed to be following. I don't think I have whatever spark he gave you when he chose you to slog into the wind in front of the rest of us with his lantern. But wherever he may be leading you, I can at least help cover your back along the way.
Chapter 18. Fort Terrace, Shiloh Province, Republic of Sittermark. The rain was picking up again. The wind-driven drops came in clusters, like tiny, icy hooves galloping across any exposed skin, but they didn't seem to bother the accursed heretics very much, General Larray's walk-ear observed grimly as he listened to the exploding shells. He and his beleaguered command were ringed by heretic positions. Sittermarkians coming down O'Hodlin's Gap from the north, Carizians driving up from the south, and he was unhappily certain that their infantry, at least, had managed to join hands after all, trekking through the narrow, winding paths above the gap. Guided, no doubt, by the local heretics who hated everything the faithful stood for, and had only awaited this moment for revenge.
Well, of course their infantry's linked up, he thought bitterly. They've got frigging artillery into the hills. Sure as Shan Wei, they've been able to move their damned infantry wherever they want it.
He'd discovered the hard way that all the rumors about the Carizian rifles had been only too true, but the vague reports he'd received about angle guns hadn't meant much to him. He'd had no experience from which to conceptualize what they were or did. Now, unfortunately, he understood all too well. The heavy angle guns were bad enough, lobbying their massive shells into the fort from miles away to the south. The craters they blew into the dead ground behind the earthworks were huge, and what they did to brickwork was incredible. Yet the small, mobile ones were even worse when it came to simple mayhem. There were endless numbers of them. They moved rapidly from place to place, and his men could never know where or when the next plunging torrent of shrapnel would replace the rain.